We'd like to thank our friends at PwC for their support, partnership, and collaboration in making Retail Gets Real. Learn more about how PwC helps retailers at pwc.com.
What really constitutes disruption, I think, is understanding what your customer wants and getting ahead of it before anybody else. But I think the only way really in the long term you can do that is by having a culture of trying new things.
I'm Bill Thorne from the National Retail Federation, and this is Retail Gets Real, where we talk about retail's most fascinating leaders about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. Today, I'm turning over the microphone to my friend and colleague, Jen Overstreet.
Thanks, Bill. Today, I'm here with James Mullen, SVP of Global Innovation at GDR Creative Intelligence. James follows innovation trends for a living, and today we're going to talk to him about the retail innovation trends on the horizon and what retailers should be paying attention to be players in the future. Chris Stewart is here with me today as co-host. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jen.
And hey, James. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us, just as we get started, tell us a little bit more about what you and GDR Creative Intelligence is.
So we sit at the intersection of brands and the way they communicate and interact with customers. So everything from brands like CPG giants, people like Procter & Gamble, to retailers, traditional retailers. We've worked at one point or another with almost every major retailer in the US. And in the UK, it's the likes of Tesco and Waitrose. We work with hospitality groups, so hotel chains and travel companies, people like Royal Caribbean. And yeah, and even technology companies, so the likes of Microsoft, Samsung, and others we've worked with. And we're looking at all different ways that they can present what they do and that point of interaction with a customer and how do they basically make that better, in a nutshell.
So what is your role in all of that?
So my role is kind of on the strategic team, which is basically to, particularly we're growing in terms of project work. So we're trying to work on a more strategic level with a lot of our clients to, in the past, we were a traditional kind of trends organization, looking at how retail's changing, presenting it, and then kind of leading them to it. Increasingly now, we're actually involved in helping them determine what to do with it, actionable strategies, consultancy, I guess you'd call it in the old-fashioned way. And so the bit I love about my job is I'm taking a brief from all these different types of companies all the time, and I can be 1 minute talking about a hair care product in a far-flung part of Southeast Asia, and then the next minute I'm talking about the floating to the future at Royal Caribbean. And that kind of diversity is kind of really exciting. And yeah, so what that means we have to have is a very kind of overview of what we think is changing across every sector. But the one that really we hang our hat on is retail, because it's the one we do the most. So we shop every day, right? And so that actually has a huge influence on people's expectations outside of retail. So hospitality and, you know, travel and everything.
Yeah.
So what are you telling your clients? What is retail now? I mean, retail seems to be so much more than retail. The consumers are changing the way they're shopping. They're changing the way they think about retailers. What are the big trends that you're seeing that you're advising your clients on?
So, yeah, I mean, completely. Like the old idea of retail was the idea that it was the mediating point between supply and demand. So if you needed everything from a toothbrush to an automobile, you went to a retailer, probably a physical box, could be different shapes and sizes, but it was one thing. And it kind of was one social contract that everybody understood. They went in, paid their goods and left. That's completely been ripped up. Obviously, a little bit to a certain extent by the internet over the last sort of 15 years. Once that's reached certain saturation, we're about, 10% across retail in the US and more like 20% in Europe. Of course, in Asia, it's higher than that altogether. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing, we're predicting very rapid shift in the fragmentation of retail away from just pure physical stores. Stores will always be important, but there's a whole proliferation of ways that you can now interact with a brand, you know, social media being an obvious one. And the way that you interact and exchange and have retail moments with the brands you care about is completely diversifying and changing every day. Probably we're seeing something new that's interesting. So clients want to stay on top of that. And so we're helping them understand the trajectory, what consumers are expecting. But really, we're trying to kind of then help them, I hate using the word future-proof, but basically that's what we're doing, get ahead of what we think is going to happen so they can kind of start planning their strategy and even develop the concepts that they think are going to win in the future.
I'm so interested by this idea of that social contract that you talked about, where, you know, it was very well known. I mean, people have been shopping at physical stores for millennia, right? I mean, centuries. And and so we know how that works. You go to the store and then there's that certain social contract, and now it's just being completely upended and consumers are driving that change, but they don't quite know what is that contract? What does it even look like anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one thing I've been talking about in recent months, and I think it's quite a nice way of kind of dichotomy, is thinking about retailing as two different things, which is shopping and buying. Right. And buying is when you want to get the things you just need to live your life that you don't really invest a lot of energy in thinking about. So I mentioned a toothbrush, but you know, those kind of things. Yeah. A lot of the space are actually kind of, in some ways, a lot of our clients see it actually. So helping make that basically more convenience driven, more fast and frictionless, and making those necessary evils just simple. People don't want to engage. And the idea of retail, they'd rather not think about it. But the other end of the spectrum is the shopping, which is the more leisurely activity. It's more slow. It's a savored activity. It's the kind of eatily experience, frankly, where you go and educate yourself about the pastas you're buying, and you walk around with a lovely glass of wine, and it's all rather wonderful. But the point is, the same shopper, and I'm totally guilty of this, on different days can be completely different in the way they interact. So one day, I'm prepared to have the really slow experience and explore, you know, the pasta. And other days, I'm like, just get me in and get me out of here. Like, you know. And so you need to cater for both types of customer, but recognizing, I think the harder place, everyone talks, the buzzword in the last few years amongst a lot of our clients has been around experiential retail. And we've seen that with every kind of flagship you see in San Francisco and New York. It's kind of moving in that direction. But arguably, I'd say that the much bigger piece of the puzzle, and actually clearly the much more scalable area, is in this buying journey and how you can make that the simplest choice for customers. Because if you get that right, funnily enough, they're less interested in things like price. And actually, you can end up making much better margins when they're more interested in, you know, you being able to rely on you, abdicate the decision-making to you as a retailer or as a brand to look after their needs.
I'm not sure I understand that. Is that what you're talking about in the convenience side?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're kind of saying before you get to the experience part, you have to have the convenience part too?
Well, it kind of depends on you as a retailer. Like, I imagine if I'm buying a car, of course people do buy cars online. It's increasingly growing that way. But I still think I want to validate that purchase with, I'm going to take some time over it, quite obviously. But there's a space probably that the most shopped spaces, like grocery, I think Eataly is a good example. There's Eataly on one hand and Amazon Go on the other. They both sell groceries, but in two very different ways. And of course, you need to have the nuts and bolts of retail sorted out first. There's no point in having a wonderful experience in a store if then it takes you an hour to check out, and they haven't got, you know, the simplistic things in place that make it easy for you to do what you need to do. But yeah, the answer is you need to cater to both. And I think increasingly we're seeing a diversification. I talked before about there being one idea of what a store was, and it was different shapes and sizes. But increasingly, we're seeing a complete diversification of that same thing. So you have everything. I think of Uniqlo as an example. They have massive flagships that are all beautiful, colorful, they've even got some with kind of coffee bars and lounge spaces and that kind of thing. And then the other end of the spectrum, they've got vending machines in airports that sell products by the gates of, you know, you're going somewhere cold and you're flying out of somewhere warm, like California, where we're recording this right now. And then they put a Uniqlo vending machine right by the gate when you're flying to Alaska because, shoot, you realize you forgot a down jacket. And incredibly, at a couple of airports where we've seen the numbers, they are selling an awful lot of product through that execution. So which is the better model? I mean, probably in terms of square footage and the cost of all that kind of thing, it's probably better doing it that way. But you can't have that vending machine without having the brand marketing piece, which is the bigger stores, the bigger brand that sits outside it. And increasingly with, particularly in things like apparel and those spaces, retail stores understand now that it's not just about filling a store full of SKUs and the more you put in there, the more you sell. That's changed now because, you know, a lot of times you're happy to go in, try on something and buy it later online or have it shipped to you. And actually, it's a great experience. Everlane in New York, if you're buying denim there, You can try it on, you can get it everything you want, but they do not let you walk out with a jean. You have to have it shipped. And they say, oh, we'll take care of the cost. It's actually, unless I need it right there and then, which most of the time you don't, it's a great experience. You don't have to carry heavy bags around. It's, you know, Walmart bought Bonobos, same thing. Those guide shops have proliferated very quickly because it's a model people understand. Nordstrom's doing the same thing with their local stores. Mm-hmm. Small footprints, kind of what you might call experiential, but also still actually super convenient. So they're not one or the other. The two things can coexist.
So talking about that idea of stores, it's, you know, retailers are reimagining their stores and they're looking at them as fulfillment centers. But now, you know, you're saying, well, they're also, that's just an opportunity for brand awareness and brand validation, as you said. And that's just an interesting idea. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're seeing with that in the trends for the physical retail spaces?
Yeah, it's pretty much as simple as that, is that you need to have stores still, yeah, to remind people you exist to a certain extent. And you're right, in the future, why can't they operate as inner city fulfillment centers rather, yeah, than having, you know, in the Amazon way, a big warehouse out of town somewhere. Mm-hmm. Increasingly, if we move to a future where people are going to come to expect 1-2 hour shipping, like what we're seeing already from Prime in New York and elsewhere. When you buy Amazon Prime 2 hour shipping, you know, for groceries, they go to Whole Foods and get it from you off the shelf. They don't go to a fulfillment center out of town. And in China, where we're seeing this completely proliferate, Alibaba's driving it in their own spaces, Huma supermarkets, or Hippo Fresh they're now, mm-hmm, called, I think. But also they're building out mom and pop stores enormously with their technologies. Mm-hmm. To mean that if you're within a 5 mile radius of a store, you can expect those groceries or whatever it is you're buying within 30 minutes, which, you think about it, it's incredible. I mean, that rise in expectation. So clearly that means you can't just give up stores and start having fulfillment centers out of town, because quite quickly you'll be left behind in that environment where people start to expect things quickly. It's still not got there yet here in most parts of the US and Europe. You know, you expect 1-2 day shipping would be pretty fast still, but it's not difficult to imagine where this is going to go. You can see the trajectory already that people want things quicker. And again, it's moving away from the idea of what is important to people. It used to be product assortment and price. Increasingly, actually, convenience outweighs price every time, because especially for kind of everyday purchases, do I really care if the toothpaste I'm buying is an extra 50 cents or a dollar if it means I'm going to get it right now and I need it? The answer is no.
Absolutely.
For all,
yeah,
but the most price sensitive. And of course, we're seeing this diversification of retail generally, where the very, very low end, so the Dollar General and the, you know, all those, you know, Aldi and Lidl in Europe, and they're growing here as well, all those spaces are growing. Family Dollar and all those kind of stores, because there's growth in that space with, you know, gig economy workers and all this kind of stuff. But there's also huge growth at the top end, and where there isn't really any growth at all is smack bang in the middle, where most legacy American companies were built to serve. You know, dare I say it, Sears and others. Mm-hmm. So you need to think about who your audience is, who you're offering your products to, and then build out as appropriate. You know, this isn't going to be relevant for those brands where, you know, people are still prepared to go in store and buy it off the shelves in, you know, a dollar store.
Yeah. I was thinking about the gig economy and retailers using these gig workers for fulfillment and things like that. And I was thinking about the challenge that exists with retailers ensuring that these gig workers are good representatives of their brand.
Yeah.
Yes. Especially when experience is so important and all these touch points are so important.
Completely. And I think that's growing quicker than anyone was ready for. So, you know, as we move to a future where things will need to be delivered, and again, it's taken outside the confines that you can control of the physical store, very few retailers have got a supply chain as sophisticated enough to handle it all themselves. Of course, you're ending up using FedEx and UPS and Amazon often. And in the UK, it's the likes of Ocado. Like, if you shop at Waitrose now, your experience of Waitrose might actually be largely your interactions with your regular Ocado driver who comes to deliver your groceries once a week. And weirdly, if that goes sour for any reason, it's Waitrose that suffers, despite the fact they have very little control over that. So it is a challenge. We're seeing obviously that it comes down to trainings and the right relationships with the right brands, and how they hire is increasingly important to retailers. But you know, we're seeing now that Amazon, you know, always at the forefront of everything. You can't avoid mentioning them. They are building out their own incredibly sophisticated supply chain. They're offering $10,000 and 3 months pay for people to start working as delivery drivers within the US for Amazon. And actually, there's huge demand. The only reason it's slower to get off the ground than it might otherwise be is because Mercedes can't supply the vans they need quick enough. But it's happening. So what Amazon's doing with its gig economy workers is kind of, as I understand they do with Uber, they require their drivers to take selfies, regular points throughout the day. So every delivery point, various intervals to check they are who they say they are, where they say they are, to moderate that. So they have a kind of, you know, line of a straight line through what's going on, a paper trail, and a, you know, a line of command about what how people are behaving, and they can obviously keep tabs on that. But they're also doing some slightly, perhaps more nefarious things, like planting fake packages in the deliveries they give drivers to test their how scrupulous they are, because some packages that are deliberately undeliverable, and the idea is that you're supposed to return it, of course, to the depot and say this one isn't right, something, you know, what is the address wasn't right or whatever. But actually, they're also leaving it deliberately open, that actually if the driver stole it, they think they'd get away with it, to root out the kind of drivers that aren't good people. It's funny. Like, I was talking to, you know, I've spent a lot of time working with hospitality groups, you know, hotels, and also I remember talking to a guy who ran a delivery company, and I said, how do you hire for these sort of jobs? Because of course, a delivery driver, you think the main criteria would be, can they drive a truck? Increasingly, it's actually easier to teach a nice person to drive a truck,
sure,
than it is to teach a truck driver to be nice. And so we're starting to see that the way you hire is actually, fun enough, less about expertise and you know, skill sets. It often comes down to their emotional intelligence. And it's exactly the same in a store now, because in a store environment, you can be heavily enabled by technology. You know, you can, if you run a shoe shop, you can check what's out the back very quickly using an iPad or whatever it is. You don't necessarily have to be scuttling about lifting heavy boxes. You don't need some big burly guy that can do all those jobs. You need people who can interact with customers, understand them, have high emotional intelligence enabled by technology. That's where I think hiring is going to go, and that applies to retailers themselves, but also the gig economy workers that they want to engage with.
I'm just kind of fascinated about the whole process of innovation and where people, you know, how people approach it. You know, it used to be like retailers would have innovation labs, and some retailers still do this, so they have like a separate innovation lab where they have all these people developing all these new concepts. Other people have decided that, no, this is more of a organizational wide, like everybody's in charge of innovation. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, since you follow trends and you see, you know, the companies that are really ahead of things, what works? What is the process that works? What should retailers be striving for when they think, I want to be an innovative brand, I want to try things, I want to fail fast, I want to do all the things you're supposed to do to get ahead?
Yeah, yeah.
What works?
That's a really interesting question. There's no right kind of blueprint, but because you're right, sometimes an innovation lab really works. They come up with some really great ideas. Other times, when you have an innovation lab, everybody else abdicates innovation to the innovation lab. So if they don't do a great job, then nothing happens. So there's kind of no right way. And other people want to be involved in innovation, but they're not in the innovation lab. So I actually think that the trend towards innovation labs that was hot sort of 3-5 years ago, possibly is a bit more measured now. But that's not to say it isn't the right idea. I know several companies we work with who have an innovation lab and do a great job. But really, it comes down to, I think, a culture shift within big organizations. So again, I keep going back to Amazon, but the amount of money Amazon puts into research and development, if top of my head, it's something like $23 billion in 2018. Staggeringly large amount. But the point was, it's up 40% on what it was the previous year. Because,
you know, 40%?
40%. Because Jeff Bezos is obsessed with customers, and you know, there's lots of famous quotes about what he says about that. But fundamentally, he's scared of his customers, and that's how he wants it to be. He wants to be constantly getting ahead of it. And it's it's a funny one because everyone talks about disruption and failing fast and wanting to innovate. And there's a great quote from a guy I follow on LinkedIn who I can't remember his name now, but he often says about, you know, everyone wants to fail fast as long as they're not failing. And everyone wants to be, you know, innovative, but everyone wants to be disruptive, but no one wants to be disrupted. You know, you don't want your work to be disrupted. And it's easy to say it.
Right.
And disruption has become a kind of anodyne word that means nothing because, oh, that it's something you don't really understand. You go, oh, well, that's disruption. You put it in a box and fine. And the idea about what really is disruptive is changing, you know, is making a razor four blades and then five blades. Is that disruptive?
Right.
I don't know. So what really constitutes disruption, I think, is understanding what your customer wants and getting ahead of it before anybody else. So how you do that is, you know, there's lots of approaches, but I think the only way really in the long term you can do that is by having a culture of trying new things. And we've worked with some brands where, and I won't name names, but where they're very, very nice people. And that's almost the problem. They're too nice. Everybody in the organization, you know, someone comes up with an idea and they say, oh, that's a great idea. And, you know, things change very slowly. It's sort of, and actually they've said to me once, I want you to come in and challenge these guys to argue more, to fall out. Because again, if you have an idea and everybody else in the room nods and says, what a great idea, it's probably not a very good idea because it's too safe. And if you want to innovate and genuinely trial new things and be disruptive, you need to actually be prepared to go against the grain, fall out a little bit. And yes, it won't always work, but that comes from the culture within your organization. It's easy for startups because they're built to be mm-hmm. disruptive to a particular industry. So their whole modus operandi is about that.
And they attract the people, those kinds of people too.
Yeah, typically, yeah, younger people who, you know, who get it. But I think in a big organization, there's almost so much to lose that the safe option is not to, you try a few new things, you innovate a bit, but really, if you're doing things you know are going to work, then you're just playing, you know, you're just doing table stakes. And actually what you think is a great new initiative that you're really excited about, when you market it and tell the press, they're like, you know, we've seen this before, it's nothing exciting. So yeah, this is a very long answer to your question, but I think there isn't a blueprint. But it has to come at a very high level from the culture. The whole company has to start being prepared to think differently.
I was thinking about, you know, Jeff Bezos is, you know, obsessed with the customer, and retailers, it's just all about being where the customer is. And so, you know, we're talking about the cars that, you know, you have the screen with, oh, here's your Dunkin' app and your Starbucks app, and you're right where the customer is, or you can shop from Instagram now.
Yeah.
And I was thinking too about these, you know, brands being a part of going where the customer is and being in customers' homes and going to them. And you mentioned earlier, you know, the door-to-door salesmen, how they used to literally be in customers' homes. And there's almost that, I was thinking of it almost as a full circle where it's going back to that, where they are coming back into customers' homes like that.
Yeah. So a quote I love is a guy from Richard Kestenbaum, who's an investor basically. And I follow him on LinkedIn, and he's got this great, great quote that I think sums up nicely. Is everyone's obsessed with talking about omni-channel, but actually the really savvy brands are talking about being omnipresent.
Yeah.
So to your point, being where the customer wants you in the right time, in the right context. So that might be the dashboard of your car. If you're General Motors, now you can touch the dash and buy a Starbucks. Mm-hmm. But it might be, again, I keep coming back to Amazon, but it might be having an Echo and having Alexa right there in the room with you when you need to ask a question or get something. And the point about the vacuum cleaner salesman back in the 70s was he would go door to door across the country trying to stick his foot in the door to sell you a vacuum cleaner. And that was very hard work.
Yeah.
Now we're actively inviting brands back right. into our homes. So it might be that you have Alexa sitting there listening to all me and my wife's arguments, or it might be that you invite an Enjoy expert. They partner with AT&T, the guy behind JCPenney.
Is
one of the big funders of it, where you'd invite somebody to your home to help set up some technology mm-hmm. or, you know, your phone, whatever it is that you're having, you're changing over for a new iPhone or whatever it is, and you're having your cloud up done. They don't have to do that in the store now. They can come to your home.
Yeah.
But that opportunity is huge, because how often do you get that incredible amount of effectively free ethnographic research where you can understand what is James interested in? How many kids has he got? You know, there's a surfboard against the wall. This guy might like surfing. He's got a bike. He must like cycling. Mm-hmm. That allows you, maybe not in every single individual transaction, to make more money than you probably have done in the old model. But eventually it will, because you have customer lifetime customer value. Customers get used to that kind of interaction. You eventually do need smaller footprint stores, so that saves money. But again, it comes back to, despite the proliferation of technology, for the most part at the moment anyway, it still comes back to people being still very important, human to human. In the long term, that may change. We talk a lot about kind of centaurs right now, which is the idea that in the same way that a centaur in Greek mythology was half man, half horse, because sometimes it was helpful to have the legs of a horse and run really fast, but you liked to have the mind of a human and the opposable thumbs of a human. In the same way now it is with technology and humans, that sometimes technology is super helpful to get things done quickly and efficiently and the data that comes out of it, but other times the human being who's able to smile, have that connection, is at the moment still really important. In 10, 15 years, they will always be important, but that will have changed somewhat. Where that will go is kind of anyone's guess.
Yeah.
When you think about technologies and the applications of technologies, I'm curious, in your experiences and your roles, what's something that you feel is just completely overhyped? A trend or a technology application or...
Well, I can think of one purely because I got excited about it and I think I was wrong, which was beacons. So what was it, 2014, something like that, 2013, I don't know whenever it was, when beacons was first a thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, this is totally awesome. Mm-hmm. Like you could walk around a store and they'll know exactly where you are and ping me with relevant messages. Now, I don't want to say the technology's dead because it probably some people are still using it. And I still, to this day, get various notifications all around the world from a retailer in London who's definitely not there saying, thank you for shopping in our store. So clearly someone sold a bunch of beacons and didn't do enough of a job early on of, that was a really early execution. But there is, I still think they do have potential, but maybe the beacon technology itself clearly hasn't come to fruition the way I expected it to. And now there are other alternatives. And the way your phone is set up now, actually, you're probably better off using just GPS half the time. So that'd be the one that leaps to mind, to be perfectly honest with you. And I still think voice at the moment, everyone goes nuts for voice. And you see some very, very ambitious projections from the likes of Gartner, you know, really well-respected companies predicting that, you know, something like 25% of all our interactions will be voice in the next 10, 12 months. I'm like, that just doesn't resonate. I think I'm a pretty early adopter with things. That just doesn't feel quite right at the moment. So it will be a thing, but I think, again, I should caution from, you know, people will get overexcited and then there'll be another thing. And you know, you could talk about Oculus as well. You could talk about all those kind of things. I mean, Facebook, I had lunch with some guys at Facebook recently who said they genuinely think that in 8 years, we will all be walking around with an augmented glass.
In 8 years.
That was, they were very specific about that. And so they were saying to me, if I were you, I would avoid investing in airlines. I'd avoid investing in property that's way out, that's sort of on the periphery of a big city. Because if there's a future in 8 years where you and I can sit like we are now across a table, but we can sit in different parts of the world and talk just instantly through an augmented reality glass and have a conversation, it may not ever be quite like this, but better than effectively the WebEx type scenario. Why do we need to be flying all over the place? And why would I need to live on the periphery of a big city like London when I could, if I had to be in the office one day a week, I might as well live in Edinburgh or in the US sense, you know, all the cost of living in San Francisco, you could actually happily live way past Napa somewhere. And
well, except your delivery time, you know, now you're fulfilling.
Yeah, there's that. That's
issue.
A good point. Yeah, you're right.
So you're pretty forward thinking. I mean, you're looking, you know, years down the road. Is there anything that, any trend that is coming or that did come that surprised you that you just never saw it coming?
I can't think of one. That doesn't mean that makes it sound like I've never been surprised. I definitely have. But I can't think of something that's really taken me, like, you know, hit me sideways. I think...
What do you think is... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I guess the one that I think I probably didn't expect to see as quick as we have is this direct-to-fridge delivery. The idea that you start letting customers into your home to stock your fridge for all your Walmart shopping when you're not even there.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Makes total sense. And yet, I didn't expect to see it yet because things take a bit of time for me to get, I don't have the technology to provide for it. I don't have a smart lock on my flat, but if I did, would I really want someone wandering into my flat, you know, disturbing my dog? I don't know. Would I be? It's the same way that right now I spend half the time cleaning before the cleaner comes because
right.
I don't want her to think that
well, that's
I'm
the thing. I mean, the insides of refrigerators get very messy.
Yeah. So the principle, if you put in, you know, it sounds great.
Yeah.
The reality, we'll see, but it's here. It's being tested in three cities in the US now, having had a fairly robust trial in Silicon Valley last year. So that, I suppose, has surprised me that it's already here. I mean, great.
Well, and there's so much concern about consumer privacy, and we don't want, you know, we want to make sure that brands are safeguarding the information we're giving them. And at the same time, absolutely, I'm not home. Please come in.
Yeah.
Look at my refrigerator.
Yeah, exactly. It's, but I would say in the same way that if I told you 7 years ago that I'd be going home drunk after a night out and getting into a stranger's Prius,
right,
you'd think I was mad, but it's kind of what I do every Friday now. So
right.
This is coming. And people will adjust pretty quickly because they do.
Well, and the convenience factor helps.
Yeah.
All right, James, we are almost out of time, but before we go, we have one more segment and it's called Rapid Fire.
One of our favorite segments on Retail Gets Real is Rapid Fire. Thanks to our sponsor, PwC.
For this segment, we're just going to ask you a couple quick questions. Don't think about it. Just say the first thing that pops into your mind real quick. Okay.
Okay.
What's your must-see TV?
I'm a sports fan, so this won't make sense to anybody in America, but Match of the Day with a cup of tea back in the London, that is my dream. That's when my wife knows I have an hour and a half to myself that she is not to disturb me.
Good. What's some favorite advice that you've received? I don't want to say the best because, you know, we keep getting new advice all the time.
Well, my first job was as a journalist, and the best advice I ever got in that role, and I still think it holds up in lots of other jobs, is that the stupidest question is the one you never ask.
Yeah.
And so I've tended to, in all my relationships, personally and professionally, try to just be really honest. And if it's a stupid question, I still tend to ask it. I tend to caveat it with that exact quote, though, so people don't think I'm an idiot. But yeah, that's probably the best advice I can think of.
Nice. What's the last thing you geeked out over?
Geeked out over? I do have a digital watch. I kind of obsess with things like that. I don't know. I did have a jawbone. I'm kind of obsessed with kind of self-actualization about steps and my activity, mainly because I'm not as active as I'd like to be. But I'm not really, for all that I work in technology, and we talk about technology a lot, I don't consider myself very geeky actually at all. And half the time I need someone's help wiring the TV up, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you reading these days?
What am I reading these days? Well, my favorite author is, well, I've got two, Sebastian Faulks and P.G. Wodehouse. So I'm actually right now rereading a very ancient book from, I think, 1950-odd about a P.G. Wodehouse character that's very underrated called Peacemith. And if anyone has the opportunity to read it, it's absolutely hilarious. Yeah, but it's all, the thing is, again, this is me being very British here, but it's all about cricket, so it might not make much sense to half your audience.
Okay, I've got the last one. What's your pet peeve? What just makes you go off on a rant?
I'm very impatient, waiting. And I know that's a symptom of the time that we're in. But I was once myself, you know, I've worked way back when in call centers and, you know, calling people home to wait for things in a store even now. I was talking to someone one of the guys who was right at the beginning of Ritz-Carlton's life, and he said back in those days, if people had to wait 4 minutes for check-in, they got angry. He said, now, do you know how long it is? 20 seconds. And I'm unfortunately, shamefully, one of those people. So,
I think I might be one too. That's all right.
I think we all might be.
All right. James, it was so nice talking to you today. Thanks for joining us. And Chris, thanks for being my co-host today.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks, thank guys. You all for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. You can find more about today's discussion on our website, retailgetsreal.com, and place in your feedback and episode ideas to podcast@nrf.com. Thanks for listening.